Welcome. You're listening to the 10th episode of the Extensive Reading Podcast. 10 episodes.
Travis. 10 episodes.
10 episodes. We should be celebrating. And yeah, so here we take an
intensive look at extensive reading. And as you mentioned, I'm Travis. And you are?
Jose.
And you are our beloved listener. Thank you so much for tuning in faithfully to our podcast.
All 10 of you.
Hey, 10 episodes, not 10 listeners, right?
No. Yeah, it's about 12 last episode, but this is going to change.
There are literally dozens.
Yeah, good. So you probably remember our last two episodes where we had Dr. Antoinette Moses telling her about her readers.
Those were fantastic.
And she set us up with her editor, current editor, that's Nick Bullard. And so today we'll be interviewing him. And he has been working with Graded Readers for a long time, both as an editor and as a writer. Mm-hmm. He has made adaptations of classics into Graded Readers of different levels with different publishers. And he's done a lot of work with Oxford University Press, and we'll probably ask him a lot of questions about this particular publisher.
Mm.
And I think that's the plan.
I'm actually really looking forward to hearing a few things. First, about just the role of editing and how that may differ or how it's the same to editing any kind of book, but also adapting classics and things like that. Because I remember in our interview with Antoinette, she mentioned how she wouldn't want to adapt, and she was only interested in writing originals. And so there might be varying opinions there. And I'm interested in hearing more than one. So
yeah, she was very clear about her opinion on adaptations.
So.
I personally believe there's a lot of value to
mm-hmm.
adapted texts, and not only in terms of graded readers, but for any teacher who creates materials, the idea of adapting text to a particular audience is of interest.
Good.
And yeah.
Well, let's get to it. Unless there's anything else.
No. Let's get to it.
Let's get to it.
Okay, so we're here with Nick Bullard. Thanks for being there. And so Nick has been working in the graded reader business for a really long time, I believe, and both as an editor and as a writer, mostly adapting works into a graded reader format. And as an editor, he has a lot of experience working with Oxford University Press, as well as with other publishers, and he's also published readers at different levels with different publishing houses like OUP again, Macmillan, and more recently with Stanford Young Readers. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's fine.
Well, before anything else, could you tell us a little bit about your background before you started working with Graded Readers?
Yeah, I spent about 20 years as a teacher, as an English language teacher in a number of countries, before I escaped from teaching and moved into publishing. I went into publishing to work in ELT publishing, but I didn't go into publishing to work in graded readers publishing. That kind of happened by accident.
Mm-hmm.
And for a number of reasons to do with the way that my job evolved when I was working for Oxford University Press, I found myself after a few years looking after the entire graded readers list, which I hadn't intended to do, but which I was very happy I was very happy that that happened, and spent a very rewarding few years looking after the various graded readers lists. When I started working for Oxford, I think there were 6 bookworms at that time. I think there's now more than that.
A few.
And there were no dominoes. So a lot of those, a lot of that more recent publishing was happened sort of while I was working for Oxford University Press. And in particular, the dominoes, which we designed specifically to be a series that did all the things that bookworms didn't do, was something that I was very involved in creating as a series.
Could you tell us a bit more extensively about bookworms and dominoes? Because maybe some people in our audience are not familiar with those collections.
Or the differences, or how dominoes... you mentioned dominoes does what bookworms wasn't doing. And
yeah. Yes. Well, bookworms were designed... Until bookworms came along in the late 1980s, most graded readers looked kind of very much like educational texts, if you like. They were the sort of comprehension books that we had for learning languages at school, really. The only publisher who had really done anything about producing readers which people might actually want to read because they wanted to read the stories at that time was Heinemann, and their guided readers then became Macmillan guided readers. And that particular hole was something that Oxford University Press was very keen to fill. And it's worth thinking about how that series was put together. It was very much intended to be a series of books that people could read as though they were just reading for pleasure. So it was a collection of paperbacks in exactly the same way as any kind of mass market publisher's collection of paperbacks might look. Indeed, a huge amount of work at the beginning and then through the development of the series went into making sure the books looked like the sort of mass market paperback that you pick up in a bookstore. Right, even down to the paper, for example. And the cover design. And the instruction that was given to the designer was that this must be a book which you would not be embarrassed to be seen reading on the bus or on the subway. And I was delighted the first time I saw somebody reading a bookworm on the bus. I had to stop myself leaning over and saying, "Do you know that's exactly what you're supposed to be doing?" And so, for example, the use of black and white illustrations was not a decision that was taken for cost reasons. It was taken because if you have color illustrations, it makes the book look young. It makes the book look as though it's aimed for younger learners. On the other hand, having illustrations at all is a kind of compromise, because actually your mass market paperback doesn't have
illustrations.
Illustrations at all. So you're kind of navigating a difficult line between being an educational book and not being an educational book. And in design terms, that's clearly what happened. But also in terms of how you select the titles that you're going to put into the series. You know, these have got to be stories that people want to read. They've got to be the sort of book that they might pick up in a bookstore in their own language, they've got to have kind of page turning sort of a page turning impetus that goes through the reading. But they've also got to be graded, because otherwise people can't read. So if you don't have graded materials, readers will be reading too slowly. And if you read too slowly, you kind of start focusing on the words, you lose sight of the meaning, because you think what you've got to sort out is the meaning of the individual words rather than the meaning of the text.
That's right.
You kind of lose the wood for the trees. And so grading is critically important. You don't want a student reading to come across more than two or three words on a page that are unfamiliar to them. Because if you can handle two or three words, you can navigate those. But if it's more than that, then you're going to slow down and you're going to start decoding the text rather than actually reading the text. So that the grading is extremely important. But the grading needs to be sort of unobtrusive. So you've got to be very careful to reflect the style of the original text, if it's an adaptation. You've got to reflect that style so that it doesn't feel like it doesn't feel like it's written for the learner. It feels like it's written to carry a story. And that means that what the author or the adapter is doing is working within that restricted code that is provided by the grading scheme. The grading scheme is a list of words you can use. It's a list of grammar items
points, that's right.
you can use freely. And the author, the adapter, kind of sets their brain so that those are the only things that are in their brain. So that you don't start using words that are not in the word list because they turn out to be not available to you. But you're still writing a story. You're still primarily thinking, what is the reader going to do? Is the reader going to want to turn the page? So it's still the conversation that any good text is. It's a conversation between an author and a reader.
When the Bookworms collection first came out, which was the lowest level at the time? And has this changed over time?
Level one.
That has changed, yes. And that happens with any publishing in ELT, by the way. You always publish at a certain level, and there's always people will come to you and say, oh, we really need a lower level than this. It happens with course books, it happens certainly with readers. And indeed, introducing a starter level kind of meant that we had to break a few of the rules that we'd set up for the original series. So we did use color. So we did use, you know, it then proved to be extraordinarily difficult to write in a natural way. I mean, I think they do a very good job of being natural, but I don't think anybody would pick them up and think, oh, this is just a story. They would think this is aimed at a learner. Whereas I suspect you can get away, if somebody picks up a level two Bookworm, they might not realize it was aimed at
learners. Yeah, I agree with that. As an adapter, having to work within those parameters that you set beforehand of the language that you're going to use and the grammar points, I just for me it would be such a frustrating task, I think, to change a text and kind of mold it into these rules, whereas like I could imagine writing an original text being even less challenging than fitting a square peg into a circle hole or something.
Yeah, well, there are a number of questions.
Yeah,
you've raised a number of interesting questions there. And I'll try and answer them all. I'm not sure if I'll answer them in a sensible order.
That's okay. I apologize for that.
The first point is that it is true that it's very challenging to adapt because the original story was not written with a view to it being adapted.
Hmm.
Whereas if you were to write an original story, you might find it easier to write within a restricted code because you just wouldn't introduce all those items that would appear in an adapted story. On the other hand, that might not be such a good story. I mean, the reason that people want to read The Phantom of the Opera or Sherlock Holmes or any of those great kind of classic stories is that those are really good stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sherlock Holmes, there's yet another Sherlock Holmes movie coming out in the next few days. Well, it is in the UK anyway. The Murder on the Orient Express is just about to be released in the UK. So that's not Sherlock Holmes. That's Agatha Christie. These are great stories. These are world stories that everybody wants to be familiar
that's
with.
That's right. Yeah.
And so I think you have to do both. You have to adapt because that's the only, you know, I don't think you have to be ashamed of adapting. Now, I know you've been talking to Antoinette Moses.
Yeah, that's kind of prompted my question.
And of course, she's done a lot of work for Cambridge University Press.
Yes.
And Cambridge decided, for very good reasons, that they would not adapt. They would only have original stories. And I still think that was a mistake, mm-hmm. but I can see why they did it. And they did it for the sort of reasons that you can imagine. You know, we don't want to go into the business of adapting existing stories. But everybody adapts stories. You know, you make a movie, you change the story.
Yeah.
Of course you do. Sure, of course you adapt. You adapt it into a different mode. You translate it into another language. You're adapting it for another language. So I don't think we have to be ashamed of taking great stories and making use of them for the, you know, in order to get a good story in front of the learners. Because we also know that those are very often the stories that learners want to read.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the best-selling titles, they are very often the well-known stories. And it's not surprising.
But sorry, do you think that Cambridge decided not to do adaptations out of this concern or simply in order to create something different that was not out there?
Well, what I think and what they say are probably two different things.
Sure.
Yeah, had I been at Cambridge at that time, I might have done exactly the same thing, precisely to do something a little bit different. I think there were also all sorts of copyright reasons why they might have wanted to do that. I am confident that they had extremely good reasons for doing it. And from the point of view of the end user, it's much better that Cambridge didn't decide to do yet another Sherlock Holmes adaptation. Mm-hmm. But to do something different, because let's face it, you could get a Sherlock Holmes from Oxford or from Penguin or from Macmillan or from, you know, 10 other publishers. So, you know, what's the point of adding another one to that collection? So
that's what I was thinking.
You know, I think that's the reason that they did it. But I think what it gives you is a slightly unbalanced series because what do you do about the student who only wants to read true stories? A lot of students only want to read true stories. You go into a classroom of 15, 16, 17-year-olds, and you ask them, you know, what sort of stories they want, you will find there's a significant chunk of kids who will say, I only want to read things that are true. Very often that's a phase that people go through during their adolescence. I can remember my daughter going through that phase. So, you know, she had to read the whole of Little House on the Prairie because they were true stories. And it wouldn't have had the same impact on her if those weren't true stories. So, and similarly, you know, you're learning English to open the doors of the great stories that kick around in the English language. So why would you deprive yourself of, you know, Huckleberry Finn?
Yeah.
Or, yeah, you know, one of those great stories. So I think from the point of view of it being a coherent collection, Cambridge has a problem. Because I don't think anybody is going to simply use Cambridge titles. They're going to mix them with other collections. And because publishers have been hopeless about having the same grading scheme, that makes it very difficult for the end user. I mean, thank goodness for the Extensive Reading Foundation, who, you know, have done a lot of work in that. You know, it's quite difficult for somebody building up a library to know, oh, hang on, this is a level 3, but in that series, that's not level 3, that's level 2.
Yeah, that's
You know, and of course, you know, but at no point was it ever going to happen that publishers were going to sit down together and say, oh, let's have a coherent reading scheme. Because, you know, you had your history. You know, we weren't going to, you know, 5 years into Bookworms, we weren't going to sit down with Cambridge and say, well, let's try and have
everything.
A consistent grading scheme, because we would have had to regrade all our existing titles. And we weren't going to let Cambridge use our grading scheme because we'd spent a lot of time and money developing it. So, you know, why would we give it to somebody else?
You'd mentioned Huckleberry Finn, and I had, just preparing for this interview, I read your adaptation of Tom Sawyer, and it's been years since I've read, the original. But just how, as an adapter, how do you go about, choosing which material to cut and which segments of the story to leave out? 'Cause, the graded reader is are shorter typically, right? As well simpler in language demands.
It does depend on the original text, and it depends on the level to some extent. So with certain sorts of text, you can almost sit there with the original on one page, and you know the version that you're doing from another page, and you can often lift quite substantial chunks from one into the other. You might have to make a few changes, but with certain titles, that's possible. With other titles, you're just retelling the story. So if you take a text like Dracula, for example, that's incredibly complex language. So most adaptations of Dracula just retell the story. They don't use really any of the words that are in that are in the original. Something like Tom Sawyer, this is going back a bit, but I remember that Tom Sawyer begins with that famous one-sided dialogue of his aunt saying, "Tom, no answer." And there was no way that I was not going to begin the adaptation with that. That was the best way. That was the only way to begin that adaptation. Actually, the one thing I'm sorry about is I didn't repeat it. It should really be Tom, no answer. Tom, no answer. It should happen twice. And space just stopped that happening. But So, you know, that there are elements of the story that you could take almost verbatim, but there were other elements that you would have to retell. As I recollect, Tom Sawyer is quite a straightforward text, because it is, after all, written for children.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not particularly complex language. But of course, you have to make decisions about what you're not going to include. And you may have to cut quite a lot of text to make that possible.
And characters,
yeah, yes. Again, I can't think what characters we cut from, but I'm sure characters were cut.
Yeah.
What are the?
Because you have got to be really careful that what you don't do is write a summary of the story. Because that is a danger, and sometimes people fall into that. You think, oh, I've got to tell everything, but it turns into a summary. It's not a story. So it's actually better to make some cuts, develop the scenes that you retain to a high standard, but accept that certain scenes will disappear, which is exactly what happens if you're doing a TV or a movie adaptation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one thing that you can do sometimes is look at that adaptation. It's sometimes a really good idea to look at TV or movie adaptations and see what they took and what they cut.
So could you tell us about the most challenging aspects about adapting readers and adapting classics into readers, or just other books into readings, and the most frustrating ones, the most frustrating aspects?
I think the most frustrating is when you're working with modern original titles that you want to adapt, it's getting the rights to do that.
Okay.
Because material is in copyright, and not all authors, or not all authors' agents, or children understand what it is that you're trying to do. So it can be extremely frustrating getting the rights to original titles, simply because you kind of feel that if I could talk directly to the author, they would understand what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And you would always, in doing that, you would say, look, and sometimes that was possible, and it was very unusual if you actually got through and talked to the author. It's very unusual that you that you would find that you didn't get permission. But, you know, authors' children are much more protective of their parents' rights, I suppose, than authors themselves. Authors will just say, I'll give us the money. And once they understand what it is you're trying to do, you can send them examples of what you've done, so that they can see that it's not going to be a travesty of their work. So that can be very, very frustrating. And I think you talk to any publisher who's doing that, they will tell you the same. One has in one's head the dates that authors go out of copyright.
Got a list written on the wall.
I know who died under European and law in most countries. Copyright law is 70 years after death.
After death, that's right.
It's not in the US, yeah. But it is in most territories. And so, you know, who died in 1946? Well, H.G. Wells, I think. And if you look at... he died around. If you look at publishers' lists, suddenly there's a lot of H.G. Wells coming out as graded readers, because you wouldn't have got the rights to H.G. Wells, probably.
What about Orwell?
Orwell died in 1950.
1950, okay. So soon. 2020, mark your calendars.
Yes. So, you know, there are... you know, I'll say, I know. The most challenging is, well, I think it, the first thing is deciding at what level a story is best adapted. And there's a lot of questions that come up in your head there. First of all, you know, how does it affect the balance of the whole series? You know, we're going to do another Dickens. You know, there's lots of Dickens out there. We'll adapt another Dickens. Yeah, but we've got Dickens at level 6 already, and at level 5 and at level 4. So what are we going to do? You know, are we going to make another level 5? Should we try and get a Dickens into level 3? If we're going to do that, what would it be? So there are those sorts of questions. Those are questions that happen before you've even talked to an adapter. Mm-hmm. And then there's the challenge for the adapter. And I think most adapters will say that the most challenging thing is getting that initial story plan. Well, we talked about that before. What you're going to leave in,
yeah.
What you're going to take out, how you reduce the length, and how you reduce the difficulty. Has this story got a huge amount of flashback in it? Is that going to be a problem? Do we need to perhaps change the way the story tells itself to handle that? Is it a first-person narrative? What are the implications of that? First-person actually can be quite an easy way. It's quite easy to keep the level low if you have a first-person narrative. You know, but it's difficult to typify what the challenges are, because they're very different for different titles. Here, example, at the moment, I've just been working on an adaptation of a Damon Runyon short story. Damon Runyon died in 1946, by the way. And Damon Runyon only writes in the simple present. That's his style. Okay, and it's all very first-person narrative. What do you do? You're clearly going to stick with that first-person narrative.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want the learner to think, oh, this has been made easy for me. Because, and sometimes his insistence on using the simple present is so overwhelming that actually you can't work out what's happening in the story. And so sometimes an adapter, to make it actually simpler, you need to use a bit of past to signpost the reader through the story. But you know, that's not a challenge I've ever come across before.
Mm.
But it was actually a particular challenge with that particular story. So, you know, each story has its own challenges.
What would you say to somebody who would kind of criticize that approach? Because you're taking something that was so stylistically done, and maybe the author did it for a certain purpose, and then maybe, not saying that I agree with this, but people would say, oh, that's cutting into the authenticity of the text.
Yeah, no, I think that is an understandable objection. But okay, Damon Runyon is behind Guys and Dolls. Does anybody say, oh, Guys and Dolls is a travesty of Damon Runyon? Because it's not all in the simple present,
mm-hmm.
despite the fact that I can't remember. But you take my point. If you move into a different mode, it's somehow permitted. And I don't see why, when we're moving into another mode, when we're moving into another style of narrative, that it's not also but yeah, I mean, it has caused the most famous one was Macmillan's version of Great Gatsby, which caused a furious reaction in the US.
Mm.
Because this is our book. So Roger Ebert started out a whole trail of complaints And it wasn't about the quality of the adaptation. It was simply, you mustn't touch this. This is our book. This is a great American classic. And, you know, too bad if people can't read it. But you wouldn't object if it was translated into French.
Or even a film, right? Even when it's translated into a film, it's changed so drastically, as it has been numerous times.
Yeah. Well, people do like to have a go at those as well.
Yeah.
But the principle of doing it, is accepted.
And I think you touched on a really good point earlier, saying that by grading the language, by making it simpler, you're giving language learners the opportunity to engage with these texts in English and to have access to these things where otherwise they wouldn't have. And I think I think that's really valuable. And these stories hold their value even with the simpler language.
And you know, I don't see why we don't mind the student reading a translation in their own language.
Mm-hmm.
But we do mind them reading a translation into the version of English that they're comfortable with.
Great point.
You just have to meet the needs of the audience.
Yeah. So, Jose, I understand that you've prepared some links for our listeners today. What are those?
Some texts for anybody who's interested in doing some further listening, but some reading on this topic. And there's three very good texts on graded readers in general. One is by Peter Viney from the Extensive Reading Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's the Language Learner Literature Awards. And apparently these are some of the criteria that some of the people at the Extensive Reading Foundation have been using in order to select books, to shortlist books that then readers would vote for. Peter Viney gives his some of his particular own criteria, and you get to learn a lot about, I believe you can get to learn a lot about graded readers by having a look at it. And then there's another one by a lady called Claridge, who interviewed a number of publishers to get an idea of how they worked on grading the material. Not only in terms of the grammar or vocabulary, but in terms of information control and other aspects.
Okay, sure.
And that's how the publishers make the grade. And then there's David R. Hill's reviews. He regularly, in intervals of several years, he reviewed an incredible number of graded readers for the ELT journal. And
even series. Right.
Yeah. He goes like series by series, and I think he's read about a million graded readers. And I don't know if he's still directing the Edinburgh project for extensive reading. His reviews of graded readers and of collections of graded readers. Yes, you're right. It's not graded readers themselves, but there's different collections by different publishers. Are pretty interesting, and he's very vocal about different aspects. He's got his things that he likes and things that he doesn't like. And he's also very clear about those. So, yeah. And then apart from those three texts about graded readers in general, we have some advice for potential writers. And one is from Anne Collins from Macmillan. And this is called Writing Graded Readers and Activities for Graded Readers. And then there's also another one by Marcus Benavides, who's in charge of he publishes graded readers online. They're not online, they can be ordered online. And these are Atama e-books. And he wrote a post on two different ways of writing graded readers. You can write them what he calls in a systematic way or in a holistic way.
Yeah.
And depending on whether you work from the beginning with the guidelines given by your publisher in terms of number of head words, etc., and the grammar you can use, or you can just work intuitively into your story and then revise it following those guidelines, and that can be useful. And then finally, I have one by Richard McAndrew, who maybe many in our audience know from his thrillers. He writes very good thrillers, graded readers that are thrillers. And he tells the story of a story that he wrote and that took many years to get published.
Over 16 years.
Yeah, that's it. Right? That's the story of a reader, 16 years, 5 publishers, 1 book. So it's very encouraging.
Yeah, especially if anybody's
having trouble.
Even not just writing, but an artist who feels that their work is being overlooked.
Yeah, maybe Van Gogh wouldn't have died that young.
So
had he read this.
So where can we find all of those links?
Yeah, that's on our that's on erpodcast.wordpress.com.
erpodcast.wordpress.com.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where we post our episodes and description of the episodes and some material we're posting. Yeah.
Good.
And yeah, that's not our email address, which is exrpodcast@gmail.com. And we're looking forward to your comments and feedback.
exrpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to contact us, please do. Or you can leave a comment on our WordPress. So
yeah,
either way is fine.
Please do. Yeah.
Well, is that it for us today?
That'll do for us today. Yeah. So next. Not next week, because I'm moving into a new house and I'm taking a break. So
hardly a break. I think you'll be pretty busy.
Yeah. I'll be taking a break.
Be taking a break.
Yes, you will be taking a break. I'll be taking a break from this. And yeah, then in 2 weeks, we'll be coming with the second part of our interview with Nick Bollett. Yeah, so see you in
a few weeks, or a couple weeks, right?
Yeah, and
until then,
happy reading.
Happy reading.